Welcome to episode 47 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation here at Steptoe. Chris Conti, who's a partner in Steptoe's litigation department and the firm's securities litigation and enforcement and white-collar group here in D.C. He'll be talking about new developments at the SEC. Our guest commentator is Joan McNabb, who's the Director of Privacy Education and Policy for the California Attorney General's Office. Welcome, Joan.
Thanks very much.
And before assuming her current position in 2012, she was Director of the California Office of Privacy Protection, which was a small independent education and advocacy agency. Was it an agency or was it a separate 501c3?
No, it was a state agency.
Okay. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and the record holder for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other lawyer. And I keep encountering people who are coming back here for the second and third time, and I say, just don't come back five times. I want to hang on to this record. This week in NSA, our traditional opener, boy, it's running thin on NSA news, which I'm sure the agency's glad about, but the FISA court came through renewing the controversial 215 program for another 3 months, setting up the debate over whether to renew it when it expires, when Section 215 expires at the end of May. Maybe more interesting news in the same general area. There was a actually pretty good, since I trashed him last time, I will give Ryan Gallagher of The Intercept credit for having written an actually readable article about how the British version of NSA, GCHQ, is alleged to have broken into Belgacom, the Belgian ISP, for purposes of carrying out cyber espionage. And he pulls a bunch of Snowden material together to tell that story. But probably the most interesting cyber war story, at least from the past, is a story in Bloomberg about a hack of what is presumed to be a hack of a oil pipeline, which went from Baku, former Soviet territory in Azerbaijan, to Turkey, through Turkey, and basically allowed lots and lots of oil exports without ever touching Russian territory, which really annoyed the Russians. They had a long campaign to try to stop it. Everyone expected, since it was going through Turkish or Kurdish separatist territory, that it was going to be attacked. It was buried. It was sensor laden. It had multiple mechanisms for reporting on the health of the pipeline, one wired and the other via satellite. And nonetheless, there was this big explosion in 2008, which the PKK, the Kurdish separatist slash maybe terrorist organization, took credit for. Now there's a report out that suggests that it was actually a cyber attack. They managed, interestingly, there were cameras all along the system, and the cameras all went down. All of the sensors stopped reporting. The link to the satellites went down, but they had one camera that was not attached to the same network, that was just a an infrared camera, and that showed two guys with laptops wearing nondescript uniforms walking along the pipeline with their laptops open, engaged in something which it turned out was a hack of the system, and shortly thereafter the whole system overpressured and blew up. Among the interesting things about that it was way before most people believe the U.S. and Israel were engaged in taking down the Natanz enrichment centrifuges, which, you know, the typical anti-American spiel on that is, oh, well, the Americans started cyber war. Now it looks as though the Russians started it and got away with it for longer, but not forever. So that was the news in NSA. I was hoping Michael Vadas would be here, but in fact he's off doing a big announcement tied to the Microsoft overseas warrant case. Jason, can you give us some more details on that?
Sure. At the risk of being accused of self-promotion, I'll promote what Michael's doing today.
Exactly.
So as we've discussed before many times on the podcast, the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of New York has upheld a magistrate judge's issuance of a search warrant that allows the U.S. law enforcement to seize and search emails that are stored on a Microsoft server in Dublin. And the issuance of the search warrant was challenged vigorously by Microsoft with broad support from cloud computing and other tech companies, including our clients Verizon, Cisco, HP, eBay, Salesforce, and Infor. The U.S. government's position is that the location of the data is irrelevant because the recipient of the warrant, in this case Microsoft, is subject to the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. So the U.S. government believes it doesn't have to go through the MLAT process and seek the assistance of the Irish government. The district court characterized the search warrant as not really a search warrant, but more like a hybrid subpoena, and analogized to the authority the government has, U.S. government has, to use a subpoena to compel a bank to produce transaction records from a foreign branch, notwithstanding the fact that that's not what's going on here, that the records being sought here are not Microsoft's own records, but are records belonging to a customer that are stored with Microsoft. That's now on appeal, and in an appellate brief filed last week, Microsoft argues, among other things, that the U.S. assertion of authority to seize emails stored on a foreign server puts the recipients, in this case Microsoft, but other recipients of similar search warrants, at risk of violating European privacy law, and will have significant foreign policy consequences as well. They also argue that, and this is an interesting argument that I think is right, that the U.S. would be taking the opposite position if a foreign country tried to do the same thing here and get data stored
in a New York minute.
on a U.S.-based server under the same reasoning. And in fact, they make the point that if foreign search warrants were enforceable here in the United States to get U.S.-based data, it would pose a significant threat to the privacy of Americans. We talked last week about the fact that the biggest issue with the MLAT process is the fact that our standards are higher.
Right.
So if a country with lower standards to get a warrant was able to enforce that warrant in the U.S. for based on something less than U.S. vetted probable cause, that is a privacy threat to Americans. They use the hypothetical example of the German police investigating a press leak and trying to get a search warrant for a reporter's document stored in a safe deposit box in a U.S. branch of a German bank. And they posit that this would be permissible under the U.S. government's reasoning. And they warn that that the U.S. can look forward to having foreign agents serve search warrants on Microsoft offices in foreign countries all over the world seeking emails of U.S. citizens stored in the U.S. So Michael, as you said, is filing an amicus brief on behalf of the companies I mentioned with the Second Circuit today, and there are other briefs being filed on behalf of other companies and associations as well. And the case really continues to bear watching because it has just profound consequences for everybody involved. It will have a significant impact if the U.S. loses on the way U.S. law enforcement functions in the digital world. And if the U.S. wins, it's going to have tremendous legal and economic consequences and competitiveness consequences for U.S. companies, especially those that are trying to make inroads in the cloud computing market overseas.
Well, so maybe we'll see Mike on TV today making that announcement. Nothing against you, Jason, but of the three of us, he's the most telegenic.
He is, by far. Well, you and I have faces for radio. Mike has a face for TV.
Okay, so the Sony breach is getting more and more interesting. It's not often that I get to write about cybersecurity for The Hollywood Reporter, but I did an op-ed for them saying I'm pretty sure it's North Korea. That's still my belief. I know not everybody has gone there, and suggesting that instead of blaming the victim and blaming, as David Boies did, everybody who publishes the data maybe we ought to try to find a way to make the North Koreans feel bad about this. And my suggestion was that they take a million DVDs of The Interview, which is the movie that Pyongyang is trying to stop, and just drop them on North Korea. And there's bound to be a few of them that will survive that that process. David Boies, I don't know if you saw the letter, but he has sent a letter to every big media outlet essentially saying, you've got stolen property and we will hold you responsible for any damage caused by your further distribution of that stolen information, and please confirm to us that you have destroyed all of the stolen information in your possession. I can't believe that's going to move a lot of newspapers, but it's an interesting response. Everybody's mad, and they're all getting mad at somebody other than the hackers.
Right. Although that phenomenon is not all that unusual in the abstract.
No, that's right. But this, I have to say, it's not the most persuasive letter I've ever read.
And it's also not going to, you know, a media company that gets possession of this information, however it's obtained, is not going to delete it or fail to publish it on the basis of that letter.
And you know, if I had to defend this, I'd say, well, you said you'd hold me responsible for damage caused by my distribution, but since it was inevitable that it was going to be distributed, there is no damage from my distribution of it. So that's my guess about how this will go. Aaron Sorkin has weighed in, calling the media dishonorable for publishing this. I have to say I don't remember him saying the same thing about the Manning leaks or the Snowden leaks, but suddenly when it's Hollywood whose secrets are exposed, we're supposed to think that the honor of the media is at stake. So it is an interesting breakdown. Actually, the most interesting thing in the Boies letter is Boies says this is an effort by someone who's trying to prevent Sony from releasing a movie, which we all believe to be The Interview, but that strikes me as a kind of confirmation. This is all about The Interview, and if it's all about The Interview, it makes it even more likely that it's North Korea that's doing the hacks.
Assuming it's not about Annie.
No, that's right. I know. Maybe it's shareholders of Sony who are trying to prevent Annie from being released. Okay. The other news in cybersecurity that I thought was particularly interesting, and we held it a week because we had too much last week, is the SEC's new rules for people who run large financial platforms. And I asked Chris to come on the program to talk a little bit about what the SEC has done and what it may mean for cybersecurity investors and companies.
Sure. Thanks, Stuart. Well, in November, the SEC adopted a regulation called Systems Compliance and Integrity, SCI for short. It's part of the SEC's efforts to strengthen technology controls to protect U.S. securities markets and to ensure that technology-related problems are promptly addressed and reported. Reg SCI was a response to disruptions in the U.S. securities markets over the last few years. People may recall there were issues associated with Facebook's IPO and a trading company, Knight Capital, and there were trading halts as well of certain NASDAQ-listed securities in the past. The SEC also noted, though, that in passing the reg, it was intended to protect against intrusions in the form of cybersecurity attacks, and then that was another reason for wanting to initiate this regime. Reg SCI is full of sort of defined terms, so I'm going to unfortunately have to use some of them here. But it applies essentially to operators of certain alternative trading systems, so think dark pools, and self-regulatory organizations such as clearing agencies and national security exchanges like NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange. An SCI entity will be required to implement written policies and procedures to ensure that its SCI systems, things like computers and networks that support trading, clearance and settlement, and order routing, are able to maintain the SEI entity's operational capabilities and to promote the maintenance of fair and orderly markets.
So basically they're saying if somebody trades for you, or offers a platform for trading, then they have to have special measures in place to make sure they stay up.
That's a big part of it, absolutely. And it also will extend to certain systems that are operated on behalf of the SCI entity. So the reg extends the SCI entity's obligations to its relationships with third parties.
Oh, like
as
their
well.
Lawyers.
Well, not so much. You have to be operating a system.
Oh, okay.
So it may not be the lawyers. The policies and procedures have to address business continuity and disaster recovery plans and provide for periodic testing, monitoring, and the review and updating of procedures. The SEC, in addressing and issuing these regulations, did provide guidelines and standards to the SCI entities to use in developing their policies and procedures. The regulation sets forth various responses that the entities have to take when certain events occur. The events involve a system disruption, a systems compliance issue, and a system intrusion. The latter would relate to the introduction of malware or an intrusion by an employee.
Do they have to give notice to somebody?
Well, yeah, there's all sorts of notice requirements here that I was just about to get to. So the responses actually involve taking corrective action to mitigate harm to investors in the market, immediately notifying the SEC, and providing updates as to the status of the investigation and its resolution, and performing an assessment of who was impacted by the event and how. There are annual review requirements that must be submitted to the senior management, and once senior management responds to the report, then that has to be provided to the SEC and the entity's board. The SCI entity must identify and designate responsible SCI personnel with respect to each system, and they have to design escalation procedures to promptly inform responsible SCI personnel of potential events. And a lot of the obligations, like taking corrective action and notifying the SEC and maintaining records, are all triggered based on when the SCI person has a reasonable basis to conclude that the SCI event has occurred.
So this is them saying we haven't yet been able to get the companies that are publicly traded to tell us in real time about their intrusions in any detail, or let alone to tell the investing public. But we can make the platforms do it, and that's what we're going to do.
Correct. That's right.
Very interesting. Well, and highly timely, after you've watched what happened with Sony and imagine it happening to NASDAQ,
right.
It's pretty troubling.
I think that's right. There's a clear recognition that any sort of massive disruption of the markets is a real significant, serious concern for investors and financial institutions and the like. And so the SEC's, looking around and saying, where can we go to improve both, these entities' preparedness, but also to make sure that we're going to get immediate reports of what's going on.
Well, that's very, very interesting and likely to produce a fair amount of work for forensics firms and perhaps for lawyers as well, trying to figure out how to live with all these rules.
I think that's right.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you so much. Amazingly, for those who think that Congress does nothing, the lame duck produced 5 different cybersecurity bills. Remember, we mentioned that there were some cybersecurity bills pending in the lame duck. 5 of them got through. That's the headline. The subhead is none of them mean a lot. So I'll just quickly go through them so that you can, everybody who is listening can say, oh, yeah, I know about that bill. The first one was a Border Patrol agent pay bill to which was tacked something that allows the Department of Homeland Security to spend more in order to attract cybersecurity professionals to the department. So it's a kind of pay flexibility act. Interesting for the department for sure. They need this, but not exactly a big policy issue. There is another bill requiring the DHS have a workforce strategy and an assessment plan. This is one of my pet peeves, is the number of plans and strategies that Congress demands. It's always a good thing to have a strategy, but the strategies that are written for Congress tend to be written about in about 2 weeks by interns, and so never produce the effects that Congress thinks it's going to require by demanding these strategies. Third bill is basically authority for DHS to run an integration center that provides threat information and vulnerability information to civilian agencies, the .gov agencies, and modifies the rules for breaches by those agencies, when they must disclose them, who they disclose them to. This is kind of moderately interesting. The integration center is a big deal. It's probably tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars involved in that, and it has had some impact. It's a big new mission. DHS is already running it, so it's not a major change that's being worked by the legislation, but it is substantive, and it does reinforce the existing status quo. NIST got a whole bunch of legislation, almost none of which really means anything, authorizing all kinds of cybersecurity awareness, cybersecurity research, cybersecurity workforce measures. They're all authorized. For those of you who are familiar with government, that means they aren't yet covered by appropriations, which means nothing may happen. This is just Congress saying, wouldn't it be nice if we could buy these things? So it's a shopping list without any provision for actually buying the stuff. And then finally, there's a FISMA, Federal Information Systems Management Act, revision that is mildly interesting. It again more or less confirms what DHS currently does, working for OMB and trying to keep all the other agencies on the straight and narrow with respect to security. Housekeeping, I think, is probably the best description of this, or maybe hamburger helper for legislators. Not a lot of that's new. I don't know. Did you see anything new in this?
No.
So last topic is Sony is not the only company that is suffering from an actual cyber attack designed to wipe out hard drives and cause real pain, as opposed to just steal secrets. It turns out that the Sands Resort and Casino and all of their affiliated properties, Sheldon Adelson had said something about the wisdom of maybe nuking Iran if they attacked Israel. And since he owns the Sands, he ended up on the receiving end of an Iranian, what appears to be an Iranian cyber attack that cost tens of millions of dollars and did wipe out the hard drives of a number of the resorts and casinos systems. Much of that was sort of hidden away, not discussed in any detail. I'm sure the SEC will have something to say about that. But what's interesting is now we've got two attacks on American soil essentially trying to penalize companies for saying and doing things that foreign governments feel bad about. You know, I think we're going to see more and more of this. It looks as though they can get away with it, so they're going to keep doing it.
Well, that's the last part is the most critical part. If they feel like they can get away with it, that it's going to be just enough to cause damage, but not so much that it causes a retaliatory move by the U.S. government, there's very little disincentive for them to continue to do it. And I think as more and more companies or individuals suffer this kind of retaliation for expressing their views or for putting out a product that certain countries don't like, and there is no consequence, there is no retaliation, I think that there's going to be increasing calls by the victims for the ability to take some kind of action on their own.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm right in the forefront of arguing for that, although I think trying to actually wipe out computers and hard drives in other countries is probably not where I would go first. I'd go with the DVDs
and Pyongyang
first.
Although, you know, the story, I don't know if you wanted to touch on the story, that there's speculation that Sony has engaged in DDoS attacks.
Yeah, I saw that. I don't believe that. It looks more likely that what Sony has done is, you know, you need a seed in order to pick up copies of material that's being distributed on the internet. And what Sony probably did was flood the internet with fake seeds, which said, would you like to see, you know, release 6 of the Sony documents? And when you get it, instead, it's a gigabyte of material that says over and over again, you shouldn't steal documents from Sony. And so that's probably legal, right? That's just giving people false information. Maybe it's fraud, but who's going to sue you? As opposed to actually DDoSing the servers that are offering it. Because that first story has not stood up very well to claims that there was hacking back and DDoSing. So that's my sense of the likely activity. But I agree with you that what we're seeing is an effort to force U.S. corporations to dance to foreign governments' tunes. I think I tweeted after I saw the Sands story something that said we were getting ready for a digital Pearl Harbor, and instead we got a bunch of digital Sudetenlands, where essentially the cheese is being paired off bit by bit, saying, you know, we're gonna just take this little piece, that little piece, and the inclination to appease the attackers is very strong. Well, let's turn to our guest. We're just about halfway through, Jason, do you want to start out with?
Sure, John? Sure, Joan. Welcome, and thanks again for being on the podcast.
You're welcome.
So in October 2014, for those of our listeners who don't know, Joan's office published the second annual data breach report from the California Attorney General's office. And the report looked at 167 data breaches reported in 2013 and analyzed those breach reports in various ways, and also looked at trends from the total of almost 290 breach reports from 2012 and 2013, and then made some findings and some recommendations based on that analysis. And Joan, why don't we start? Let me just ask you to tell us about the report and how it's prepared and what you think the most important findings are in this year's report.
Okay. We do, because our law requires it, get copies of the notices of breaches affecting more than 500 Californians' information, and then we collect additional information from those who provide the notices, and we look at this as an opportunity to get some insight into data practices in organizations. That, you know, a breach is an opening, but it's also an opening into practices. And among the actions that we take when we look at the breaches is an attempt to derive lessons that can be shared. And so that is our purpose in publishing these reports, is to share what we see so that others might be able to benefit from the lessons. So after 2 years that of data. We felt we could look at a couple of sectors that were fairly well represented and compare them to the others. We didn't do this with every industry sector because we didn't have enough data points. So one of the striking, and two of them stood out. Two industry sectors stood out as having a pattern of breaches that was different from the rest. And one is retail, and the pattern that was different there is the extreme predominance in the breaches that they had of hacking and malware breaches, as opposed to other types such as lost or stolen laptops or other devices containing unencrypted information, or just errors by insiders, just they did the wrong thing, sent the data to the wrong place, or even misuse by insiders, intentional misuse by insiders. So overall, hacking and malware was the most common type by 49% for the two-year period, but it was strikingly more significant in retail, 88%, and in fact, much of that was apparently targeted efforts to get quick money return from stolen payment card data. So that's one of the things we saw in retail. Another segment that was strikingly different from the rest was healthcare. And this, the unusual thing there was 70% of the breaches reported were the result of unencrypted data on mostly stolen and some lost devices, laptops, thumb drives, etc. This is dramatically different from every other sector, where only 19% of the breaches were that type. So we thought that both of those were worth pointing out, and many of our recommendations are directed specifically to those two sectors.
Found that fascinating on a couple of levels. First, the fact that as you said, statewide about 49% of breaches were the result of hacking and malware, and that means that there's a very significant percentage that are not. And I think you all found that in 2013 there were some 44% of breaches that are the result of what you might call sort of unforced errors, or at least avoidable mistakes, unintentional errors, physical theft or loss of data. And it really speaks to the fact that that there are things companies can do to try to at least mitigate the risk of the non-malware related attacks. And in the healthcare sector, that was even more striking for the reasons you said.
Mm-hmm. And in sort of contemplating, well, what's going on in healthcare, for heaven's sakes? They certainly have a long culture of confidentiality about information, but so hypothetically, it kind of looks like they might they're new to digital data, which has been a big push in healthcare in the last it's been many years now that they've been gradually turning to digital data and electronic health records, but they seem not to have sort of grasped some of the ways to protect digital data. Certainly should be doing it.
Well, especially given the requirements of federal law, do you find it surprising that healthcare companies have been so slow to adopt encryption and to adopt other security measures?
I do find it surprising, and a trend that seems to be occurring in healthcare is there is increasing use of portable devices by providers. There's sort of a BYOD issue, but there's certainly the idea that so much of this data is already not being encrypted in that environment. The idea that they are using more and more portable devices, is worrisome. So, our recommendation to them is encrypt it.
Yeah, one of the major points in the 2013 report was the importance of encryption, both as a means of protecting data and as a threshold determining factor in whether or not a reportable incident even occurred. And you emphasize again in this year's report the need for encryption to be widely adopted. Clearly in the healthcare industry there's some room for improvement there. What's your sense in other sectors about whether the message about encryption is getting through?
Well, it does. Now, this is going to be totally anecdotal, but, from years of looking at data breaches but not having all of the information on them, It seems to me that many players have gotten the message about encrypting data on laptops and portable devices, that most segments seem to have gotten that message, you know, perhaps even a while ago. But encryption, of course, can, in certain situations, also be a protection against malware and hacking, you know, against inappropriate access by insiders. So there, it's not, our recommendations, our specific recommendations about encryption have in 2013 and to some extent in 2014 have focused on data in transit. But there's also a place for encryption in the payment card network system, for encryption, for tokenization, for, you know, the new chip cards that make the number different per transaction, ways to devalue the data so that it is not such an attractive target compared to the approach of hardening the perimeter.
I thought that was a fascinating set of recommendations about making payment card data less valuable, and the report makes the observation that you know, that in those countries that have adopted chip and PIN technology, there's been a decrease in fraud in in-person card transactions, but a corresponding increase in fraud in non-in-person transactions. And the tokenization is important to combat that as well. Do you have a sense, you know, it's been widely reported that most of the major card brands are moving toward chip-enabled cards, and in October of 2015, retailers are going to face increased liability if they don't have chip-enabled point-of-sale terminals. What's your sense of how of what momentum there is for adopting tokenization?
I think there's considerable momentum. People are in retail are very much aware that they've got data that is prized and being targeted by bad actors, and there's a lot of efforts underway. One of the things that we learned as we delved into this more and more and preparing for this report was, certainly, as you point out, chip and PIN is not a silver bullet that completely protects payment card data. It's important, but it's not the full story, that there are places for tokenization and in certain stages of the movement of the data for encryption as well. And it's going to be several years before this whole system is in place, even as the cards get issued. I think the last I heard, we were over half of credit cards were already chip-enabled. But they also have a mag strip because all of the terminals aren't prepared to deal with a mag strip, or even when retailers have upgraded and have terminals, I mean, deal with a chip, that can read the chip, they don't have the software activated and the training in place. And so there's going to be a period when cards have both and some readers use it someplace, and the retailer education and the consumer education is kind of challenging. So we need to be doing other supplementary things even for card present transactions for a number of years.
Joan, let me ask you from a slightly different perspective about this. I don't see chip and PIN having a lot of security value for most of the things that we've been worried about. And it's also true that it doesn't cost consumers much to have the systems that hold their cards hacked, except in inconvenience because the cards get have to be reissued, and then they have to go through a whole process of re-enabling all of their regular payments and the like. And I wondered whether the banks aren't overreacting to these intrusions. Now that they are establishing that they can recover the cost of reissuing these cards from the merchants, it doesn't cost them anything either to reissue the cards. So they put that inconvenience on the consumer and the cost on the retailer, when it seems to me, if I remember right, maybe 5%, maybe 10% of the cards that are compromised are ever actually used. Wouldn't you think that it would be smarter if Visa and MasterCard spent some of their very substantial artificial intelligence pattern recognition capabilities on watching these cards rather than just having the banks reissue them all?
Well, I have a lot of things to say about all the points that you raised there. So let's look for. Let me start. First of all, it can be more than inconvenient, and there are costs for a consumer when a card is compromised. Particularly in the, so, for example, one of my cards that got switched out very nicely by my bank because of the Home Depot breach. One of the places where I had an automatic payment charged me $19 for the card not having worked because it had been changed. I was able to ultimately beat them down on that, but it took phone calls and a couple of letters. So that is more than inconvenient. In the case of a debit card, it can be even more serious since the money can be taken from the account even though the consumer has the right, when it's unauthorized, is going to get it back. But its absence for a period of time while the bank investigates can be, serious, not just inconvenient. And it also can lead to bounced checks, and the burden of having to deal with that is time-consuming and literally costly. So that's number one. Number two, yes, I agree that particularly in the case of credit cards, that the bank's anomaly detection system is good and gets better all the time, and that is definitely a good way to go. But it still doesn't eliminate the actual burdens for the consumer.
Yeah, but I am sort of surprised how quick on the trigger now banks are with reissuing cards, given that they have other ways to protect us and given the cost that you identified of failing to remember one of your routine regular payments. And I wonder if because of the liability imposition on the retailers, whether the banks aren't a little over-incentivized to reissue cards at the drop of a hat.
It's still the best way to go for the consumer.
It also, avoids from the credit card issuer's point of view, the bank's point of view. It's still a emerging area of the law. Their ability to recoup those losses.
That, I suppose they can't count on getting it back. Although I'm guessing
they can't count on getting it back. And then there's the impact on the smaller retailers who are particularly hard hit by something like that.
What do you think is the is the difference in the sort of level of acceptance of the need for chip enabled point of sale terminals for smaller retailers as opposed to larger ones?
I think since the big, very publicized breaches of last Christmas that all retailers are aware of it, and I would be more concerned that they're thinking it's going to be a silver bullet of some sort, but there's a cost, to them. Obviously, they upgrade terminals anyway, but the timing of it adds some cost to it.
The report noted that the 167 data breach reports that you received in 2013 was a 28% increase from the previous year, and those are, as you noted, data breaches that at least affect 500 people, so they're sizable breaches. And then even if you discount for Target and Living Social, there was a 35% increase in the number of records of California citizens affected by the breaches. Is your takeaway from that that there are more breaches, or are companies just getting better about the reporting obligations? And do you think that the increase in the number of affected records means that the breaches are getting bigger? How do you analyze that trend?
Well, to some extent, so we're looking at two data points, 2 years, so any conclusions are not hugely meaningful about the significance there. But it certainly could be that companies in 2013, more companies were aware that they need to notify the AG, because that law just took effect in 2012. So that could be a factor. The the increase in the number affected, which is real, even as you said, if you eliminate those two outliers, does, especially in the kinds of data that's being where the increase was seen, seems to indicate that there's targeting going on, that there are organizations, criminal operators who are really going after, particularly online account credentials and payment card data. So there was, in fact, a decrease from 2012 to 2013 in the number of Social Security numbers breached and the number of driver's license numbers breached. And those two are, you know, clearly very problematic for the data subjects compared to a payment card. And yet we're seeing much more interest in going after the, you know, the quicker return data.
So, Joan, one of the repeat recommendations from the previous year's report is that breach notifications be simplified. I think this year's report makes the observation that the average reading level required to understand some of the breach notices that are used now is college level, and whereas the population at large has about an eighth grade reading level, which is actually higher than I thought it was. That's a dangerous recommendation for lawyers like me and Stuart, because it could put us out of business if breach notifications were vastly simplified and written in simple language. But putting aside that it's our self-interest to keep them written by lawyers, how do you think it could be achieved that to make notices helpful but still contain sufficient information to be useful to consumers?
Well, I think there's three things to do: layout, language, and content. So layout, using headers like what happened, what information was involved, what we are doing, what you can do, so that from glancing at the page, the reader can understand what this is about. Language, you know, shorter sentences, smaller words, plain, less jargon. Content, so we analyzed very closely a fairly large chunk of the notices that came to us, and I didn't actually do this by I didn't get the percentages, so I'm making up these percentages, but it seems to me it's fairly common that on the first page where the basic information is, that half of the space is devoted to claims, to assertions of the organization's great respect for privacy, and it was somebody else's fault, not ours. It's the story of the organization's pain in the breach, and less of it is here is the kind of information was involved, and here's what you can do to protect yourself. So by flipping that proportion and having more of the airtime space devoted to here's the kind of information that was involved, here's what you can do, it's more useful to people.
You know, if we can shift gears from the report to one of the other things your office has become well known for over the last few years, which is investigations and enforcement actions brought in the wake of breaches. And let me ask you, just as a starting point there, the most frequent complaint or concern that we hear from companies that have been breached is that as soon as the breach occurs, they find themselves almost immediately the targets or subjects of investigations by federal regulators and by state AGs. And they feel like there's almost a presumption of negligence, the presumption that they were responsible for the breach, even though, you know, they were victims too. And a lot of these companies particularly complain about the standard being applied by both federal and state regulators of whether or not there was reasonable cybersecurity when there is really no meaningful definition of reasonable. So let me give you a chance to respond to that concern, because we hear it from companies in all different sectors.
Well, first, let me say that from the Attorney General's office, we do not mount an investigation on every breach reported to us. So we don't. How do we decide which ones we're going to gather more information on? Among the factors that we look at is the severity of the impact, which might be factors like what type of information is it, Like, is it medical information of particularly sensitive type? Is it social security numbers? The vulnerability of the victims? Is it children? Is it disabled people? Veterans? How long was the data exposed or out of control? How timely was the correction and the notification? You know, so that's one thing we look at. We also will be interested if it appears that there is a known vulnerability that at the root of the breach that for which there are known controls. And another thing we look at is this entity a repeat offender? Have they had other breaches of the same type in particular?
Okay. You mentioned the timeliness and notification. One of the challenges that so many companies face when they're dealing with an incident is that they have to balance their obligation, the legal obligation to notify the state and their sense of obligation to notify their customers, often at a time when they don't fully understand the nature or scope of the incident. How does your office recommend the companies handle notification when they're still in the stage where they don't fully understand what happened and they want to make sure that what they say is accurate, but yet they've got to say something?
I fully understand that concern. I've been in meetings involving over the years, breaches in state agencies, and I know exactly how challenging that can be in many circumstances. So that in some circumstances, it isn't that complicated, but in many, it is. And so I think there, it is indeed competing imperatives, timeliness without unreasonable delay is what our law says. And as do most of them, and accuracy is also important. So, among the things that might just sort of as best practice advice might be looked at in that situation is how sensitive is the data? How long has it been out of control and available for use? Is there something that the people can do right away that would protect them? Is there something that we can do right away that will protect them? And the only way you can make decisions like that is to have not only an incident response plan in place, but have policies regarding how you will notify in various circumstances, so that you're not making the whole thing up in the war room.
You know, do those last two things you mentioned, having an incident response plan in place and, having a notification plan, and then in addition, having taken other proactive measures like doing an annual or more than annual security assessment, are those factors that affect the threshold decision whether to do an investigation? You named all the other factors some of the other factors that would weigh in the calculus. Does it help a company avoid regulatory scrutiny if they can demonstrate that they actually did measures proactively to try to prepare for an incident before it occurred and that they were prepared to deal with it once it did occur?
Well, it takes some scrutiny to find that out. but obviously those are important things that we would be paying attention to. And, the need to do privacy and security assessments regularly, at least annually, is really critical. You can't know how secure you are if you don't. Your business practices change throughout the year. You have different types of data. There are new threats. You just can't assume that you've got one great big fancy audit and now you're cool.
There have been some recent changes in California privacy law, some actually prompted by the 2012 report that go into effect in just a few weeks. I thought we should spend some time talking about some of the more significant ones. First, SB 568, which is sometimes referred to as the online delete button or the right to be forgotten for minors. Can you tell us a little bit about that, who it applies to, how it's going to work?
Well, I can tell you a little about it. So it does two things. It prohibits an operator of a website or online service that's directed to minors, to that is California residents who are under the age of 18. The operator of a site or a service that's directed to minors is prohibited from selling, marketing products that those minors aren't eligible to buy, which include not just alcohol and tobacco, but also things like tanning salons. Who knew? That's thing number one. The second thing it does is it provides for what has been called an eraser button. It gives the minors, California resident minors, the right to remove information that the minor posted from the site or service where the minor posted it. So that's the overview. In a way, the marketing provision, in a way, it's similar to COPPA in that it prohibits for this population of minors not just marketing to them, but also compiling personal information for the purpose of marketing such products to them. And it contains a number of kind of safe harbor provisions. At least that's how they were intended. So it says that an operator would be deemed to be in compliance if the operator has notified ad services in the manner that the ad services wanted to be notified that this site is directed to minors. So then if an advertiser advertises on the site, the operator is not liable. It also imposes the same provisions on the ad services themselves regarding sites directed to minors once the ad service has been notified. And it also, as COPPA does, puts the same prohibitions on an operator who has actual knowledge the minor is using it. But there's the safe harbor of if they take reasonable actions in good faith to avoid marketing or advertising, they will be deemed to be in compliance. So it's intended to be workable. Now, how this will actually work and how it interacts with COPPA is not totally clear to me.
Right. We could probably spend an hour talking just about that issue.
We've gotten interesting questions about it, and I agree, it's interesting. The eraser button provision also has some sort of safe harbor-y type good faith provisions in it. So it says minors can request and obtain removal of content that they posted, that they publicly posted, only at the place where they posted it, not if it's moved, you know, been transferred on. It doesn't, it's only when the minor posted it, not when somebody else posted it about the minor. And it, the operator is in compliance if the information is no longer publicly visible, even if it's still on the server.
Do you have to be a minor to actually invoke your right to this online eraser, or is it something that if you're 22 and you now have regrets about something you did when you were 16, you can still get it erased?
Well, I can go up and take stuff that I posted off. I mean, nothing's stopping me from doing that, depending on the site and how easy they make it. But if you know, for some reason it doesn't work, the site hasn't violated any law if they didn't take my stuff down, but I have the ability to do that in most cases anyway.
But is the statute intended to apply or to be enabled?
To minors.
Only by minors. All right, for our very sparse under 18 audience, kids, if you're living in California and you're going to have regrets, have them before your 18th birthday. Another topic we could spend a significant amount of time on that we'll only be able to touch on is AB 1710, which makes a number of important changes to California privacy law, including one affecting or expanding the requirement of reasonable security measures from businesses that own or license personal information to businesses that maintain it. Tell us about that.
Well, it's. I think it was an attempt to get at what was always intended in that statute. It always said that the owner has to contractually obligate service providers who maintain the data for them to reasonable and appropriate securities, and now it just says it puts the responsibility for that also, the liability for that also on the service provider. So that's what that one was about.
And then another one that has sparked some interest in the community of lawyers who work in this area relates to the requirements for identity theft prevention and mitigation services in the event of a breach. There appears to be some confusion among commentators who have looked at the bill about exactly what it requires. Some believe that the law requires companies to provide ID theft prevention and mitigation services free of charge for 12 months in the event of a breach, and some others interpret it to mean that if a company is offering those services, the services have to be free of charge and extended for a 12-month period. Who's right in that debate?
I am familiar with that debate, and here is my opinion as a former English teacher. The ambiguity is alleged to occur because of the insertion of the phrase "if any." If any, as a modifying phrase, modifies the words right before it. The words right before it are not if any offer is made, it's if such services exist. And if you look back at the legislative history, you can see the point at which if any went in. From that point on, all the committee analyses always say if any services are available. The other point I would make is that if this provision just means that if you're going to provide a service, it has to be for free for a year, that's meaningless because it has to be for free for a year or you aren't providing it, and it's only available for a year or more. It makes no sense for it not to do that. And it has become the standard. We still see some cases where it's become a standard practice. We still see some cases where some kind of service would be called for in the case of a Social Security number or driver's license breach. But in most cases, when it's a Social Security number or driver's license, and that's the only time this new provision applies, they are providing such service anyway. So my advice is do it. If it's a driver's license or a Social Security number breach, provide a mitigation product.
All right, so that's the safer interpretation of the statute on behalf of lawyers and English teachers.
Exactly.
So, as a last question, your office gets a lot of attention for the report that we talked about earlier and for its investigations and enforcement actions. The media and observers tend to pay less attention on the public education that you do and the outreach to industry and to consumers to try to protect consumers and businesses from data breaches. I thought I'd give you an opportunity as we close just to spend a minute or so talking about the preventive measures that your office engages in.
Yeah, well, we develop and publish best practice guides, which are on our website, or anyway, recommended practice guides, where we are trying to push toward best practices. And in developing them, we consult with a broad spectrum of stakeholders and interested parties and attempt to understand the feasibility issues and the concerns and take that into account when we make our recommendations. We do lots of training and speaking engagements to spread those recommendations out to the appropriate parties. We've done a couple of things that are particularly focused on smaller and medium-sized businesses that probably aren't able to hire Steptoe or other privacy lawyers. And so we want to give them some basic information as well, because while a business may be small, it may have quite a lot of sensitive data that it needs to protect and manage appropriately. So we have a cybersecurity guide called Cybersecurity in the Golden State that isn't really just limited to being applicable to the Golden State. We have a guide to data breach response, which we are currently updating, and we'll be circulating some drafts pretty soon of the new parts of it, but it's been in existence since my old office first published in 2003. We have one on writing privacy policies that are meaningful, that give people the kind of information they want about how you manage their data, and we have one particularly focused on mobile app developers who who tend to be, in many cases, new to the privacy world, and we wanted to give them some knowledge that just start with some basic awareness of what kind of data they might be using and then how to appropriately manage and communicate that data.
Okay, thank you, Joan, and thank you for joining us today. Let me also thank Stuart Baker and Chris Conti for joining us as well. As a reminder, the Cyber Law Podcast is now open to feedback. You can send your questions, suggestions for interview candidates, or topics to cyberlawpodcast, that's one word, at steptoe.com. If you'd like to leave a message by phone, you can contact us at 1-202-862-5785. This has been episode 47 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. We're going on hiatus until the new year, but when we return, we'll be joined by Jim Lewis, the Center for Strategic International Studies, Lieutenant General Edward Carden from the U.S. Army Cyber Command, and Becky Richards from the NSA Privacy Office, although not all on the same day, I hope. We hope that you'll join us as we once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. Thanks for joining us.